New York Mayor Zoran Mamdani celebrated Tax Day by declaring, "Let's tax the rich," something you're hearing a lot from Democrats these days. But do wealth taxes actually work? Are they good for New York? Or are they just going to send the rich and their tax revenue to Florida? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. All right. So, Catherine, Mamdani's big tax day message wasn't just tax the rich. It was even more specific than that. It was, let's tax this one very specific rich guy. He was standing in front of Ken Griffin's apartment. Aren't there laws that say basically the government can't tax just one guy?
Yeah, I mean, this is obviously, he has the cover of having just been, it was a for instance. It just so happened this guy was an example of the law. But there is a point where you're getting a very, very narrow pool of victims on your tax. And in New York's case, it is people who own real estate worth more than $5 million who also do not have New York as their primary residence. So that's like not a ton of people. And the part of the tax day message that kind of cracked me up is he was like, they are reaping the incredible financial benefits of owning real estate in the greatest city in the world. It's not like if he just means New York real estate is valuable, sure, but that doesn't have anything to do with the Mamdani administration or things that you get for your taxes, really. And if he means something else, I don't know what that is.
Well, yeah, I don't know what it means either, because in fact, they're reaping a bunch of benefits of living in New York, but they're also paying a huge amount, right, Nick?
But,
I mean, like,
but definitionally, they're not living in. These are the people who are owning
property in New York, of having access to property in New York. But they're paying a huge amount, and isn't this better for New York to have rich people there who are paying into the system, paying it, like supporting the city through tax revenues, and not even in many cases using a lot of the services?
I think it's always great. And that could be the form of immigrants who the Cato Institute just released a study showing that immigrants on average put in a lot more in taxes than they take out in services. So, but that's not quite as sexy of like, you know, because Mamdani is not actually talking about bringing immigrants in. New Yorkers already pay pretty much the highest possible amounts in state and local taxes combined. The business tax is gigantic here. Wealthy people here, it's something like, you know, the top 1% of income earners in New York pay 50% of all of the city taxes. So, it's going to be popular to tax, you know, what you're saying are like billionaires, pied-à-terres, but it's not going to have that much impact on city revenue, which is a big thing. And it's not going to have that much, impact on people's behavior, because a lot of people, once you're, at a certain level of income, you know, you're kind of beyond taxes. And if we're getting people like Steven Spielberg showing up here because California's so bad, it's kind of a wash. I am
just to push back a little bit, we do see in California the threat, not even the actual implementation, the threat of a wealth tax has already resulted in a number of billionaires moving out of the city, moving out of the state, including Steven Spielberg. Several of them are not saying, oh, I'm moving out specifically because of this tax. But it's pretty clear when you move on January 1st and there's a backdated tax, that might go into effect.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, I'm in favor of lower taxes in general. There are at some level hyper high taxes cause people to change their behavior. Right. And particularly wealthy people who spend a huge amount of time and probably employ a small army of accountants to figure out things. There's a reason why a lot of rich people have pied-à-terres in New York that they go to a couple weeks a year. And it's partly because if you live in New York, you will, for half of the year, you're going to get taxed up the yin-yang for that. So it's a bad idea to be doing this. What I'm most interested in, because this is also, it isn't just in New York City. Everywhere, progressive people are saying we can just tax the rich because the rich are like, last year's printer go burr You know, you just print more money, you just bilk more billionaires. It doesn't quite work that way. But reframing all of this, the real question in New York is like, it has the highest state and local tax, you know, combined taxes. What are we getting for that? We spend $35,000 a year to educate a shrinking number of people, of kids in the K through 12 education, public school education, and most of them cannot even read at grade level. So like, I'm, you know, I understand why Mamdani says, let's tax the rich. That's, you know, that's a golden oldie. I think we need to be starting to talk about what are we getting for the money that the city is spending? Because New York also spends about 30 or 40% more per person than LA does. And LA is a shithole. And when it comes to city services, so is New York. That's the conversation that I wish we were having.
Whenever Matt, you've lived in Los Angeles and New York, what are you getting for this?
And DC. So I've got the trifecta. Yeah.
Well, so you're going to retire to Chicago.
Yeah. Right? the last one to go. That is the ultimate element of frustration. When I hear someone who's a politician in my jurisdiction say that we need to tax the rich gleefully, little fingers and pointing, and I'm doing social media. What I hear is that the current level of spending that we have here is unacceptably low. I just disagree with that. The tax rate is, as Nick pointed out, the highest burden in the country. It's a progressive tax system. But still, if you are poor or middle class, you get taxed a hell of a lot more than almost everybody does everywhere. He ran on affordability. How does raising taxes affect affordability? I'll tell you, it makes things less affordable. That's how.
I think his argument would just be that it doesn't matter for someone like Ken Griffin, who can afford an apartment that isn't even his main place, that is a couple $100 million. He's trying to make the city more affordable for middle class people, maybe even people like you. I'm not saying I agree with that. I'm saying I think that would be the response.
But like, why is raising taxes the problem? Because in his mind, we're not spending enough money. If the government only spent more money, which we will get by trying to get this guy's money taxed more than it is because he's not living here 183 days out of the year, then somehow we'll slosh that money back into somewhere and it'll make things more affordable. It's incoherent. It is taking at a base level that we don't spend enough money and that the services that we are getting are acceptable. If you walk around, if you live in New York City and you say, take a deep breath, just breathe it all in and then kind of walk around you or try to drive a car down a street, you are going to come face to face with unacceptable services. Nick said $35,000 per student. I think it's closer to $38,000 per student right now that's spent. Like, you see bad service all around you on the basic things that you interact with city government in. So anytime you like tax the rich, that's going to solve it. No, because you can't solve it now the way that you spend and govern money right now. And that way also taxes currently right now the middle class and the poorest 20% more than people who live in almost any other city in the country. It's bad governance, and it is a please move out of my city move from Mamdani, and I will eventually take him up on it.
What is fascinating about all of this conversation, and again, it's not just New York, it's everywhere. People are like, oh yeah, we should tax the rich more, or more and more people seem to be saying that. Like, when you look at polling, anywhere from 50 to like 78%, according to like looking at a bunch of polls to prepare for this, we're like, oh yeah, the rich can pay more. You know, and it's like, yeah, you know, and on some level they can. But in New York City, compared to 2014, the budget of New York City is about double. We have fewer people living here. The services generally are not good. People come here that nobody's coming here for the trash collection. Nobody's coming here for the, you know, and I'm thinking about this a lot, as I'm sure Matt is, because the thaw is upon us, but like for the unbelievable bouquet of odors that you cannot get in any other city in the world, maybe, you know, short of Calcutta. But, you know, people are not coming here for the city services. They're coming for everything else. But the government here keeps spending more and more money and delivering less and less. And then their solution, which is politically incredibly popular, and we need to, as libertarians, we need to confront and dismantle this message. It's like, oh, if we only had more money, if we only spent $70,000 per kid in public school, fewer kids would go to public schools, and they'd do even worse. Like, I mean, that's the trajectory that we're on.
I also think there's kind of, it's the same logic for these like pied-à-terre taxes and some wealth taxes that you see with cigarette taxes, because they can't do both the things they're designed to do simultaneously effectively. Either they're raising revenue or they're discouraging certain types of behavior. But if you successfully discourage the behavior, it doesn't raise the revenue. So, you know, which thing is it that we want? Do we want people to stop smoking, or do we want to fund the state government? Like, do we want people to stop having pied-à-terres, or do we want to fund the city government? Like, the halfway in between creates all kinds of mixed incentives that make politicians behave in even crazier ways.
There was a very funny story out of state government about a decade ago that I wrote about, where after the master settlement agreement with the big tobacco company, the states basically had turned big tobacco into a revenue center for them that they used to fund public health programs. And then when people stopped smoking, they were like, we don't have enough money for public health. They didn't quite say people need to smoke more, but too few people smoking became a problem for their public health programs. But this also goes back to when the wealth taxes have been tried in Europe, Matt. They have then been untried because they don't raise revenue. You just see capital flight. And I don't understand why Democrats in blue states like California, like New York, like Massachusetts, even in Maine now, they're trying stuff. Yeah. It's not for billionaires. It's like it's a 2% surcharge on income in excess of $1 million. This just went into effect. I don't understand that they don't seem to understand that Florida and Texas exist.
Yeah. And I mean, Mom Donnie thing is ultimately kind of trivial. It's more of like a social media gesture than anything that's live and going to affect a lot of people. The California proposal is so absolutely bananas that now the state kind of political class has to decide how much it wants to sort of scramble back and say, no, we're not really doing that. Please stop moving away. It's terrible. It is akin to rent control in that if you poll economists, you're going to get a really high number in the high 90s saying that's just a dumb idea. It's not going to produce the thing that you say that you want to have produced. And it's going to create really bad incentives. That's going to make worse policy. It's kind of universally discovered. And Democrats just don't care. They just don't. You could care. You could notice that rent control is terrible every time, or you could just say, eh, it's good politics and we're on the left and the other people on the right. So this is what we're going to do. It's more like, you know, when is the Trumpian populist right going to discover this for themselves, too, and start doing the same idiotic, proven to never work policies? That's just the country that and the policy suite that we live in. And it's an important thing to remember, as always, because everyone's so fixated on national and presidential politics at every single moment. But it is here where there is a big divergence between the two parties on state and local policies. Generally speaking, this is a Democratic kind of idea. These suite of ideas are Democratic ideas, and Republicans don't have those ideas for the most part. And thankfully for that. And you see a divergence of governance at the state and local level between the two parties because of that.
And, you know, but it's also interesting that a place like Florida is becoming less affordable. And, you know, taxes are part of it. But Florida has, you know, great tax policy, particularly if you're old or retired. Like, you know, they like virtually all of the former Confederate states are unbelievably kind to retirees. And, you know, Florida is one of the leaders in that. But it's becoming less and less affordable because housing is expensive, and housing is like, you know, jobs and housing and proximity to jobs and housing are like the three things that people want. Tax policy, you know, in general is not the driver either for people flocking someplace or leaving someplace, but it does matter. So Florida is going to be, you know, they're going to need to figure out a way to make housing more affordable there. And they're not going to be able to do it by cutting taxes. They're going to have to loosen up whatever is holding things back there.
Yeah, one thing you don't see in Florida is the kind of contempt, the kind of smugness. You know, I mean, Matt described this as a sort of social media stunt. But Catherine, I actually just want to sort of ask you about this. Like, this is something beyond the policy, right? Beyond the sort of specifics of the this won't work governance. There is just this kind of gross smugness and contempt that our colleague Billy Binion tweeted about that emanates out of Mamdani in particular, but really the entire, a huge amount of the Democratic Party right now. And I don't see like how that is sustainable, given that they're basically showing contempt for the people who are driving the American economy.
It's particularly weird in New York, right? Like, I think I sort of, I mean, you can tell a story about how, like, the people who made money by moving around money, as opposed to making things or serving their communities or whatever, like, that's a longstanding story. You know, speculators are often villains. If you go all the way back, we've got, you know, usury laws. Like, this idea that you make money by moving around money has deep, deep roots in humanity in terms of being something to be suspicious of. But New York is a city built on making money by moving around money. Like, those high-rises and penthouses don't exist except for the making money by moving around money guys. And so to somehow suggest that they are undermining the soul of the city just seems particularly wild to me, because they are the soul of the city. But people like to eat the rich. But I think there's a particular subset of the rich, which is Ken Griffin. And it's easy to hate on those guys.
Are we really going to sit here and be, oh God, it's hard to understand why people dislike Bill Ackman and would like to tax him at 1,000% of his income.
Don't tax his income. Tax his tweets.
No,
tax him per word on the tweets.
That would be wonderful. Per syllable. You know, break it down. You know, and double tax him on schwa's, right?
But the First Amendment would like a word.
You know, but like, billionaires right now are in a particularly bad odor. And a lot of that is just your basic kind of, you know, eat the rich envy. And a lot of it is because people like Elon Musk are repugnant in public discourse. They take sides. They're kind of mentally retarded, you know, on everything other than the one thing that they tend to be good at, which
is
like, you know, shooting rockets in
space. We're not going to bring that word back.
Well, it's a medical condition. That's why it had an adjective in front of it. But
Didn't you just tell us about the First Amendment, Catherine?
But First Amendment, no, I mean, this is one of the reasons why it is possible when you have, you know, people like Peter Thiel or other founders of Palantir starting to talk about why we need, you know, mandatory national service. And plus, like, democracy and freedom, you know, democracy and economic, you know, kind of productivity are not really compatible, things like that. Yeah, you know, billionaires to some degree are bringing this on themselves. Most of them are acting badly when they step outside of the lane of, like, I produce a lot of economic value. So,
all right,
you know, I think we need to be thinking about that.
Speaking of bad odors, we're going to be right back with a discussion of pot. Weed legalization in America on 420. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme is Reason and Love. It explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, Alexis de Tocqueville. They'll be in small, dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't just sit through lectures. They're going to practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students will have other activities they can explore: Chicago's landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week. Scholarships are also available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. All right. Happy 420. Let's talk about pot legalization in America. It's quite idiosyncratic, right? It's not the same state to state. But overall, I think it's pretty clear the trend has been toward legalization for well over a decade now. That's basically good. And on Saturday, it's not just pot, right? It's drugs in general. Saturday, Trump signed an executive order on psychedelic drug research. Joe Rogan was in attendance to see this signed. Nick, what do you think about the order? And specifically, what do you think about Joe Rogan, who has become this kind of interesting alt-cultural figure being there?
Well, you know, it's particularly about psychedelics. And Joe Rogan is one of the people who has, you know, really kind of promoted or, you know, shown a light on the use of psychedelics, particularly for veterans and victims of sexual assault and things like that. The ability of psychedelics to help people move past PTSD or trauma more broadly. He was flanked by a couple of people, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who talked to Reason when he was running for president and said he was in favor of, you know, decriminalizing psychedelics broadly, but also pushing their medical use for things like this. Brian Hubbard, who was the subject of a profile in Reason, who is one of the big advocates of Ibogaine as a way of getting past a lot of brain injury and things like that. So that the picture, and if you broaden the picture out a little bit more, there's a guy named Matt Zorn, who is part of Trump's candidate cabinet. He is he's a psychedelics advisor to RFK Jr. These people have been making very good and important and compelling and necessary medical cases for the use of psychedelics in the Veterans Administration and other parts of the country. And to his credit, Donald Trump, you know, the least psychedelic person in the world has never wavered. He has talked about this. He talked about it when he signed the executive order, which helps kind of push everything. And it's going to, you know, ideally push the FDA into crediting a bunch of substances with breakthrough therapy status. So it's all good. I went to a march for cognitive liberty yesterday because this is also, you know, it's 420. It's also Bicycle Day, which is a big psychedelic holiday. And one of the people who were there.
Does it have to do with bicycles?
It does.
Two wheels.
Albert Hoffman.
It's
420 or 419. It's all a little bit fuzzy, as many things with psychedelics are. But Albert Hoffman, the Swiss chemist who synthesized LSD, accidentally ingested LSD and then took a bicycle ride while he started tripping balls. And it's, you know, so this commemorates that. It came into being maybe 30 or 40 years ago.
And that's how we got bike lanes.
One of the people, you're not going to stay in the lane, trust me, if you're riding a bike on LSD. But one of the speakers started off, you know, and she was like, I was going to give a speech about everything that the government should be doing about psychedelics. And she was like, not a Trump person. And she was like, and I got to say, you know, like, I don't really have anything to add to what the president did yesterday. So this is good. And it's in that longer sweep, Peter, that you were talking about. It's really been over 50 years that people have been moving towards drug legalization, both of weed and of other substances. And it is because America is growing up. It's becoming more adult. We are more interested in consuming and using more substances that allow us to be who we want to be, to show up the way we want to show up. And that includes psychedelics, not just for PTSD, but also for fun and for emotional growth and things like that. This is all part and parcel of that. It's a good thing.
Well, it's also because of libertarians. And I mean, this has been one of the most consistent things that libertarians have stood for is drug legalization, not just pot, but especially pot. But as we have won this battle, partially, sort of slowly, idiosyncratically, it seems like there's been some backlash, Catherine. And so I guess I just sort of want to see if you can talk to people who are maybe a little skeptical. They feel like they've seen, well, we tried pot legalization, we tried some harder drug legalization or decriminalization in places like Oregon, and there's been some disorder. It feels like maybe it hasn't worked so well. There's a lot of bad smells on the street. And so bring this back to first principles. Like, talk us through like what the big picture libertarian position is and how it is responsive to the concerns that have come up as drugs have become more legal.
I think so much of the backlash, especially with marijuana, has been about public use of marijuana. And so, you know, I think that's sort of an underappreciated element of this. Like, yes, the people who are kind of dyed-in-the-wool prohibitionists will say, well, here's some statistics on, you know, some of the you know, maybe there's traffic accident statistics, maybe there's youth, you know, schizophrenia, that kind of thing. But for the most part, those numbers are all highly debated. Reason has addressed a bunch of those in Jacob Sullum's work and Aaron Brown's work. But what people really are objecting to is like, I can see people smoking weed, and I used to not see people smoking weed when it was illegal. My guess, my belief is that we're probably past the peak of this backlash, in part because all the technologies for consuming marijuana discreetly and in private have gotten much better and are going to keep getting better. So I actually think there's just a very it's a problem of mores. It's a problem of etiquette much more than it is a problem of law. And
just to push back a little bit, I mean, something I have seen quite a bit recently discussed on Twitter, X, whatever we're going to call it, is some new research showing that a significant percentage of like young men are using pot to some degree or another most days of the month. And that's not public use. That's mostly private. In many cases, it appears to be pretty small amounts, you know, probably just to help people go to sleep in a lot of cases. But there are persistent, you know, users who are using quite large amounts in some cases. And this has become one of the talking points amongst the backlashers.
Yeah, I just think that that will be countermanded and counterbalanced by the fact by the same dynamic that you got with gay marriage. Like, if everyone realizes that they all know these young men who are using cannabis on the regular and they are basically high functioning normal people, which is true, then the kind of panic about what's happening behind closed doors also goes away. Like, addiction is real. And, you know, very different depending on different drugs. And, you know, there's been a big...
An addiction existed when pot was illegal.
And it
this is the thing that I always want to... Like, your solution is to go back to the regime where it was prohibited, where people went to jail?
There were no potheads before. I remember
that. It didn't happen in the 1980s. I mean, I guess I was nine. But, like, they existed. And... It was a problem that like there were addiction was a problem then, and it wasn't a problem that was solved by making it illegal.
But I mean, it is true that being able to vape weed as opposed to having to pack a bowl or roll a joint is much easier, or to eat an edible. And I do think it's worth taking seriously problematic use, which, you know, teen use is down, particularly in places that have legalized recreational pot. You know, so that, which makes perfect sense when you think about it for a while. If you have licensed places that sell weed and the black market, you know, shrinks a little bit, licensed dealers, you know, in dispensaries are not going to sell to 16-year-old kids, et cetera. But we, you know, it's not a problem for that. There are problematic users and we need to deal with them, but we need to recognize that that is not increasing because of legalization. And there are facts about this that need to be talked about. The other thing, you know, in a Gallup had a poll that showed a decline in the number of people who favored legalized weed. Almost all of that, according to their analysis, came from Republicans. And it, even though Donald Trump, you know, Donald Trump signed an order to reschedule marijuana from being a Schedule I drug, the most prohibited, to something looser. And he's talked about like he would totally return the decision on whether it's legal or not to the states if Congress would actually allow him to do that, if they would put a bill across his desk. But it's Republicans, and it's because over the past year, Donald Trump, not surprisingly, has been speaking out of both sides of his mouth. He was talking about how terrible drugs were, and he ramped up a drug war against Venezuela and things like that. If you go back and if Donald Trump suddenly says, and maybe the psychedelic executive order will be the beginning of this, he's like, you know what, whatever drugs are, like, you know, they should be legal and then people can deal with them. You'll see Republicans suddenly be like, oh, yeah, I really don't mind drug legalization.
Well, he just dislikes drugs if they cross the border. Mm. I mean, I'm kind of not kidding, but
yeah.
Also,
he doesn't like the immigrant drugs. Matt, go ahead.
I suspect that some of the mild backlash we've seen against legalization is actually a backlash against public disorder and lenience towards public intoxication. Sometimes those things have gone hand in hand, like in Portland. So we're going to stop arresting people. Okay. But how about if people are just lolling about the street in fent folds all around you and you can't go to a bunch of the areas downtown that you used to go to because we're not enforcing those types of infractions or crimes or just public camping, then you think, well, the legalization was the problem here. I don't think it is. I think we have to decouple that. And I think this recent news about the recent executive order is promising on that because people, I think, are getting in their brain that you can have two separate ideas. You shouldn't have the government telling an adult what they can and can't put in their body on penalty of punishment and in the most extreme version, jail time. That's just wrong. The idea that government should, the proof should be on their side, that that is necessary to have that kind of illiberal regime. But those of us who want that kind of the removal of the government between that decision that an adult might take, I think it's incumbent upon us as well to say, hey, disorder is not great either. Just because weed is legal doesn't mean some guy can poop on my sidewalk. That's bad. Maybe enforce the don't poop on the sidewalk laws too. And hopefully that'll happen.
Privatize the sidewalks. Matt, yes. Don't
privatize
be a squish.
The poop. Yeah. I also think like,
is it,
doesn't
it start private?
I'd like pooping to be
I
really
think a
very
lot of
private.
Bums, private. A lot of bums socialize it, when they excrete on the sidewalk.
Psychedelics, I think, maybe it's this is insufficient imagination on my part, but psychedelics, I think, are going
you
to be
need more
less subject to public disorder type concerns. You sit on the stoop and smoke weed with your friends, but it's by and large, we are not going to be, I think, dealing with, was a quote around stoop or friends or what was it? What were your senior quotes,
you,
Matt?
You.
Oh, you. Yeah. One might do that. And I think
yeah, it's not going to be like Diane Linkletter's falling from the sky, right, on random right. tourists or something.
Psychedelics will have other objections that will, of course, be put forward by the prohibitionists, but I don't think it's going to be this one. And I think that that actually might be helpful in the broader debate.
All right. I think that's a pretty good transition. Matt, you mentioned illiberal regimes when we were talking about drugs here. So I want to talk about big tech, actually, and some of their policy proposals.
I really thought you were going to talk about Viktor Orban.
Nope. We did that. We did that one already. So but Matt, you don't like illiberal regimes. You don't like compulsory national service.
Don't try to do
it. And there was this thing from Palantir. On X, right? So, Matt, do you even know what Palantir is?
Yeah, I've been inside Palantir. You haven't.
Okay.
All right. Ooh.
See, I'm sorry. I was in the Hobbit's lair. I was given a secret debriefing about all the nasty shit they're doing.
Oh. I didn't even. Do you want to give us a report?
Nope.
I'm curious.
No, went on a junket about 7 years ago. Actually, this is shocking to careful listeners and viewers of Reason Roundtable, but I went on a pre-COVID junket to the Silicon Valley to spend a week at Palantir and I think Microsoft, definitely Tesla, some healthcare companies and stuff, all talking about artificial intelligence and machine learning and what was on the cutting edge coming this way. I'm like, okay, man, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Who paid for the junket, man?
This is the American Swiss Foundation. Which is obviously belong
illiberal
to.
Regimes, indeed. Yeah.
Switzerland
Did
always
you get
has nice
to blow
liberal.
Through one of those big pipes, that the Ricola guys are always using? That's
sadly no.
That and the cuckoo clock, right? And LSD. That's what the Swiss have given to
virtualization. Was a Ricola pipe?
Swiss.
All right. This is why you're our tech correspondent.
Exactly.
So you know all about Palantir, and you can explain it to us because over the weekend, posted on X, the summary of Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, his co-authored book, The Technological Republic, Hard Power, Soft Belief in the Future of the West, 22-point manifesto. And the one that I want to talk about is point number 6, national service should be a universal duty. We should, as a society, seriously consider moving away from an all-volunteer force and only fight the next war if everyone shares in the risk and the cost. And look, I know you hate the draft. You've said so many, many, many times, and I agree with you. But the argument here is that if you are sharing risk and cost, maybe that makes war, and in particular, stupid wars, like the one we are currently having in Iran, less likely because everybody feels the pain.
Do you think Peter Thiel's daughters are going to sign up for national service? Honest question. Do you think that
you're the tech correspondent? You tell me.
Here's the answer. No. Did Donald Trump serve in the Vietnam War? No. Yeah. No. There is no such thing as shared national service. What there is dreams of elite people and these fucking 20-sided die rolling, mask wearing, bong ripping, self-important motherfuckers at Palantir.
Do you need a full disclosure about your own Dungeons and Dragons
dissertating? Yeah,
your Dungeons and Dragons and Lord of the Rings consumption when you were a teenager.
That's fine.
Yeah. We'll just let that go unspoken.
We all move about.
Matt was playing the real game, which was Stratomatic Baseball.
Thank you for your testimony. I would.
I got nothing. nothing.
So national service is a bad idea because you own your own body and you own your own person, and no government should be telling what an own person should do with their own body. I thought we had the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments for a reason. No national service, no draft. Stop telling me what my kids are going to do for your national project. You can go take a very long walk off a very short pier. I would like to read another paragraph at this at the risk of opening up another window and jeopardizing the whole technology of this podcast.
Is it about how Elvis really was destroyed by the draft?
Listen to this.
He never really came back after being drafted.
The 22-point thing. The decadence of a culture or civilization, and indeed its ruling class, will be forgiven only if that culture is capable of delivering economic growth and security for the public. Are we self-importanting enough? For crying out loud, Jesus Christ, just be a tech company. I understand you have some ideas about stuff and you've gotten involved with the government and you have this sort of like pro-defense and pro-nationalism stuff. There's some points in these 22 points that I kind of lean towards agreeing with or understanding. I just don't understand why I need to hear any of them from Palantir or anybody named Karp. But it's the sense of self-importance, and this is something that is absolutely suffused with Silicon Valley. It was true when I was there. It's always been true. Anytime you meet someone, it's not just that they're inventing a cool new technology. They are redefining the nation state as we know it. Like, okay, I'm glad that we all have projects, and some of them are indeed going to be world shaping, but my God, stop huffing your own farts.
I mean, are they redefining the nation state as we know it, or are they just reinventing tech bro or urbanism? I mean, just to bring this back full circle here, right? Like, that sounds like the sort of thing that you would hear from one of those people who was paid by Hungary to say how awesome Orban was.
I mean,
right?
It's a through line to a lot of Peter Thiel world efforts is to kind of cast doubt on the Enlightenment and cast doubt on the sort of projects. What's interesting about this, the projects of like Enlightenment, liberalism. What's interesting about this particular thing is that it kind of goes back and forth. Like part of one of the points says that we should not take for granted that we haven't had a major world war in 75, 80 years. And that is in part because of the American-led order. That's not usually what you hear from the Orbanites of the world anymore. So at least they're having somewhat of dissonance from it. But for the most part, like, just I don't care. People who have just learned about politics 5 years ago, 5 months ago, are interesting to watch as orangutans flinging their own poop at a zoo. But it's not where I'm getting any kind of sustenance from.
What's with all the poo issues?
So much poo in this podcast.
Sustenance,
Catherine. Yeah. What do you think about there's like other parts to this here, right? Like, so OpenAI released this big document calling for a new deal for the AI era, right? I'm sure you're very excited about that. But one of the things in it was a proposal for a public wealth fund that would provide, and this is a quote, every citizen, including those not invested in financial markets, with a stake in AI-driven economic growth. That kind of sounds like universal basic income.
By the way, I have a Nick Gillespie fund that I think everybody would benefit by investing like compulsory through taxes. You'll get some of it, but it's important to me. And I think Nick Gillespie is pretty important.
We're all investing in Nitcoin at the end of this. Yeah. That's actually going to be the next ad read.
I'm a transformative technology.
Right. I mean, if I want to make a normal argument, like, this isn't super bizarre. This is basically what Alaska does for oil revenues, but that's not great either. And then there's Elon Musk last week tweeting about how we all need universal high income because of AI, right? And sadly, the high income is not a reference to 420, but like, you're a robots person. You think they're awesome. AI is great. Don't you worry that they are going to lead to a massive welfare state when the people behind them are telling us that it's going to require a massive welfare state?
I think the people behind them are telling us it would be easier for the AI companies if we had this kind of massive welfare state, and they sure would like one, and they would appreciate it if we essentially socialized the risks of the gale of creative destruction that is about to sweep through. And like, they're entitled to make that argument. Of course, I would, quite reasonably expect that there will be cronyism at play here. They will be looking to buy influence. I am with Matt that I have a special kind of, I don't know if it's rage. It might be rage for people who were successful at one thing, somewhere in their lives and think, therefore, that they can show up in D.C. and fix everything. And like, I love the good intentions. I do. And I appreciate that they recognize that, like, once they've solved one big thing and they look around for the next big thing, politics are the big problem. Like, government is the big problem that needs fixing. That's true. That's an accurate assessment. But it's like, I'm going to hold a conference. I'm going to propose a UBI. I'm going to do whatever. And then it's all going to be fixed. No, we are 250 years into working really hard on this thing. And it's like, it's only going OK. We know. But like, you're not the guy who's going to come in and solve it. So I think this idea of, you know, just asking for Washington to perform what is almost like a PR function here of making the bad parts about AI feel less bad. That's not a fair ask. And it's also ultimately going to be extremely harmful, right? If you take away the ability of the market to perceive and price in the downsides, you get a much less efficient response to the new technology. And that's a problem for everyone.
All right. Yeah. It's like a guy has a successful cocktail newsletter, thinks he can host a podcast.
Crazy times.
We'll be right back with a listener question about progressivism, the New Deal, and Locke after this. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. So you know what makes people worry? Money problems. Financial stress. At the start of this year, 88% of Americans reported feeling some form of financial stress. Money worries often bring anxiety, sleep disruption, even depression. Financial difficulties are also one of the leading sources of conflict for couples. If you are struggling with money or feelings of anxiety around your finances, that doesn't mean you failed. It might just mean that you need to find the right kind of support. And that is where therapy from BetterHelp comes in. Therapy is not about financial advice or telling you how to invest. It's about managing your stress. It's about figuring out what to do with all of the frustration that can come with financial difficulties. It's about helping you build better coping strategies so that you don't feel alone. BetterHelp is going to help match you with a therapist using a short questionnaire. If you're not happy with the match, you can switch to a different therapist anytime. These recommendations are tailored directly to you. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform. BetterHelp has served over 6 million people globally, and it works. BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session, and that's based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So when life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. Sign up, get 10% off at betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's betterhelp.com/roundtable. All right, a reminder, we love to answer your questions. Please send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. And please, please, please put listener question. Where's listener question? That should be your subject line so that I know when I'm going through all the questions, which one is a listener question, which one is a spam ad for something on Spotify that I don't even know anything about. Be like Jonathan, because Jonathan wrote the words listener question in his subject line, and he wants to know. On Wednesday, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas made remarks at the University of Texas, Austin. In an excerpt published later by the Wall Street Journal, he opined that the Lockean interpretation of natural rights, as articulated in the Declaration of Independence, the one from the American Founders, he specifies, not to be confused with a similarly titled 2011 book, is in direct opposition to the understanding of rights held by progressivism and Woodrow Wilson. I come away from reading this wondering if Locke is given any quarter by either the White House or the legislative branch, or rather if understanding our two main parties as left and right wings of the Progressive Party neatly explains the present state of American politics. Nick and Matt, you were both mentioned by implication. Who wants to take this one first?
Matt does.
I'll go first.
All right.
So the what I like about the posing of this question is the recognition that we're seeing a right progressivism right now. And I think that's obvious. I'll just throw as an aside, everyone should go read the Wall Street Journal excerpts from Clarence Thomas. I'd seen this described on Twitter as like, oh, what a horribly politicized speech he gave. And this just shows that maybe he shouldn't say stuff like that on Supreme Court. It's like totally unobjectionable speech trashing Woodrow Wilson and progressivism. Like, we all have agreed. We've just decided, because mostly Rutgers, but other reasons, that like Woodrow Wilson was terrible in the progressive era.
Princeton.
Even if you love
Princeton.
It.
Princeton.
Whatever. It's all the same. Yeah. it was kind of a stain. And like, even, you know, they made a radical departure from constitutional declaration independence tethered thing, whether it was Woodrow Wilson or Teddy Roosevelt or any of those bastards. Yeah. That was all fine. I wish that Clarence Thomas would bring that vibe to some of his votes about presidential power. He was talking not just about Locke, but especially about Madison and the Federalists. And they understood that man has fallen and that governments are going to abuse their power and go against their even the highest first principles. And so we need these competitions between branches and to diffuse the power. I think some of Clarence Thomas's decisions, particularly the last couple of years, have tilted more towards presidential executive power at the direct expense of an already self-withering legislative branch. I just think the comp between Donald Trump and FDR is much, much greater than people realize. He's the only person who's competing with FDR on the number of executive orders. He is trying to badger the Supreme Court in ways that we haven't really seen since FDR. I think he's just a right progressive. So, yes, I appreciate the point that you make and largely agree with it.
Although he did just sign an executive order that Nick likes about psychedelics. Nick, what do you think?
Second most of what Matt said, and we'll just add that, you know, where Thomas is kind of playing fast and loose with stuff is that he's not calling out progressivism as something that also has roots in the Republican Party. And I think why that's important is because Teddy Roosevelt before Wilson, was progressive. And we have to understand that progressivism was not some kind of partisan turn. It was something that was a background that changed and everything settles into it. And I think we're settling into that now, because there is a right-wing version of progressivism, which I think is best understood just that the government, particularly the federal government, can tell you what to do on more and more things, however you act, because they know better or they have more guns or they are more powerful. It doesn't have to emanate from like deep principles. But we're to the extent that we're shifting into a new era of a neo-progressivism or something, we recognize then that libertarians are the actual counterweight. And we need to be looking for libertarian Democrats and Republicans to counter this, to say, no, the government should be doing less for all sorts of reasons. First and foremost, because they don't have the right to do this, like, you know, in a philosophical sense, but then also constantly be talking about the pragmatics of this and the empiricism behind it, of that when the government does more, society does worse, and that there's a right-wing version of that and a left-wing version. And if you oppose that, come work with libertarians who, you know, and we can totally kick the ass of this, you know, cancer that is metastasizing on the body politic.
I also think there's just, you know, in this speech or in the part of it that was excerpted in the journal, he rightly notes that this was a dark era for the court, right? He says, you know, my court, Plessy v. Ferguson, Buck v. Bell, like the ways in which the court failed to check some of the worst excesses of this era are instructive. And I would love for him to apply that on some of what I think are the worst excesses of our current era. And he doesn't always, but there is this framework that is present in these remarks of an understanding of what the court's role is, which is to always be looking back to those founding words.
Yeah, it's a good speech and a good question. Thank you, Jonathan. Let's check in on Iran. So can anybody describe whether or not the Strait of Hormuz is open as we record this podcast today?
Yes, it is exactly as open as the Department of Education.
But considerably,
okay, so how open
but
is
considerably less open than when, you know, before the war started.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a paradox.
Is the Department of Education
considerably less open yeah. than it was before the second Trump administration
DHS,
started?
Right? DHS. Is DHS open or closed?
Schrodinger's Department of Education, yeah. Schrodinger's Strait of Hormuz. It's open, except it's not, except it will be, except there are boats being
you
attacked.
You find out by putting a boat through it.
We have to pass the boat through the Strait of Hormuz to find out what's in it. Yeah. Thank you, Nancy Pelosi. All right, like, so
that's it. That's our commentary.
This is,
Peter.
I have absolute right. Like, Matt, my question.
My main question
is
Palantir.
Is the Strait of, yeah, mm-hmm. You work for Palantir. Actually, Palantir probably knows, right? Because the main thing they do is like crazy surveillance stuff, target identification.
Do we know if they're working for the Iranian government though? Because they're kind of mama. They work for a lot of governments.
I think they're not in there.
If we had national service, we could finally free the Strait of Hormuz like it was 2 months ago.
Okay, so the war in Iran looked like it was winding down. And this is the thing, the serious point that I want to make is it looked like it was winding down. We had this 2-week ceasefire, which is over on Wednesday. But now it seems like there has been some shots fired, right? Like the United States blocked a ship coming out of some Iranian port, right? There are people speed running through the Strait of Hormuz and maybe getting fired at. It's somewhat unclear. And it seems like it's hard to say as we record this, but it does seem like the conflict is maybe just going to keep going, Catherine, right? Like, and we are going to end up in exactly the forever war that Trump promised we wouldn't end up in.
Yes, it does seem like that. I agree.
Matt, Nick, you got anything else?
Yes. Just that, like, I've thought this from the beginning of the war that Trump is not, he doesn't have a in his bones understanding that overwhelming military superiority. It's hard to say. Does not mean that you have strategic negotiating advantage. That's really like it is kind of hard to accept. It's counterintuitive, but Iranians live there. And they're going to live there forever, and we are not. And we are not putting boots on the ground. Iranians know this. And you can threaten to wipe the entire civilization clean off the planet every other Tuesday on Truth Social. You can say a lot of seemingly intemperate things. You can invoke Allah. You could say a lot. And you could bomb the living crap out of everything and sink 90% of them. You could do all of that stuff, but Iranians are still going to live there. And your overwhelming military superiority is not going to make them sign a deal that they don't want to sign, or at least like try to figure out a way to make it more favorable to them. You could just tell Trump doesn't want to be in this war forever. He doesn't want it. It's bad. He knows it's bad for him politically. He knows that it's brought side effects that he doesn't like and put pressure on his own political party. And he's frustrated by that, by all reporting. And he didn't plan it, especially about the Strait of Hormuz, very well, by all reporting. He wants it to be gone. They know he wants it to be gone off of it. And so I would not be surprised at all if at the end of all of this, we are basically back to something that resembles much more the JCPOA agreement from 10 years ago, from 15 years ago, than what Trump was talking about in the initial days of the war. When the other side of the negotiating party knows that you really, really want something, and that's also true of the JCPOA. American side wanted that so badly, they're kind of willing to do anything to make that happen and probably made a lot of sacrifices that they shouldn't have in that negotiating process as well. So I don't think it's going to be a forever war, but it's going to be a forever suck. And certainly it's going to make us think, I think, certainly, that we're going to look back on this and say, why did that happen?
All right. Let's talk about some things that do not suck. Nick Gillespie, what do you got for us for our cultural recommendations this week?
I am watching the second season of Your Friends and Neighbors, the Apple TV show that stars John Hamm as a big money guy who loses his job in the first season and then becomes a cat burglar in a very Tony, it's like set in Connecticut or Westchester, a very ritzy area. And the second season just started. It is a very funny and interesting show. It is, a step down from Mad Men, where I'm sure John Hamm is making more money. But it's enjoyable partly because, we've been talking about billionaires lately and people hating billionaires or very wealthy people. And this is part of that vernacular that is really getting trotted out where, I'll be talking about the Netflix show Beef in a future episode, which is also like this, where there's a renewed interest in how the very rich live and how awful they are when you go inside their homes and whatnot. And this is very much part of that. It's very you know, it's a fun show. It's an enjoyable show. I don't know if it is worth paying an Apple TV subscription.
Well, there's other good stuff on Apple. I like it. And I actually like the second season a little bit better than the first season, at least what we've seen of it so far. But one thing does strike me from what you are describing here about this, about Beef, is that when the first season came out, there was someone, a cultural critic, who was like, you know what? One thing that's really interesting is that portrayals of the really wealthy on television have become negative. Like it's like they're like they're all about how it's unpleasant to be incredibly rich, which is a turn even from like the Sopranos era of prestige television, where sure, we were meant to understand certainly by the end of the Sopranos that Tony Soprano was both first us and second awful, right? It was a show about how the viewers of the Sopranos were awful. But it was also in the first couple of seasons about how he was relatively well off and powerful. And there was something fun and exciting about that.
Well, I think, you know, what I've been thinking a lot about is the British kitchen sink cinema of the late 50s and early 60s, which, you know, as in a post-war England, people were moving up and a bunch of shows like depicted what life was like for the upper classes. And they were like, oh my God, it's awful. You don't want this. And it, the best way to read it, I think, is that it was a cautionary tale by people who own the means of cultural production saying, like, you don't want to be rich. Be happy in your little neighborhoods, you know, in your working class neighborhoods. It's a much better life. It's more meaningful. It's all empty upstairs. There's a great movie called The Room at the Top that explicitly had that message. And what I think we're going through now, Peter, you know, to your point is, what has shifted is it's no longer fun to be rich or to be in the houses of the rich. But what we're learning is that the rich are absolutely morally corrupt and decadent, kind of like echoes of that Palantir line.
And that's what's why we need to tax their pied-à-terres. Well,
absolutely. No, but what is particularly interesting is that the, you know, some of the critiques, and this, you know, Beef we'll talk about, you know, maybe next week. But, you know, there's a lesson of like, well, you know what? The rich scam, you know, they scam their way to wealth just like we all do. And we all like shoplift a little and we all skim, we all scam, et cetera. And this becomes a much more interesting and dark phenomenon where it's like everybody at every level of income, education, you know, demography, we're all bullshit artists. And that, you know, that's, it's a dark turn, but it also makes for a lot of entertaining television.
I also read a book about this. I read England, England by Julian Barnes. He's like the Flaubert's Parrot and Sense of an Ending guy. This is a book, it was published in 1998. So between the two eras that we have just discussed, but absolutely on the same theme. And it's a, you know, billionaire type character, Sir Jack Pittman, who decides for his last hurrah, he will build a essentially sort of a Disneyland of England on the Isle of Wight. But it will be, he will actually take everything from real England. Like he like brings the real royal family in on this. And it's all the cliches of England in a single location. The main character is Martha, who is his kind of, well, she's originally hired as the designated cynic in the meetings about this project to sort of like naysay. And through a variety of twists, including the reveal of some strange sexual fetishes and also a murder, she becomes the CEO and then ends up in the end. Sorry, spoilers, but it came out in 1998. Ends up in the end on Albion, which is what England was. It's the rest of England, which has collapsed into a pastoral parody of itself. But in all of these contexts, people are playing the roles of Englishmen. Like there's a point on England, England, which is the name of the theme park, where the guy playing Robin Hood like becomes Robin. Like he starts shooting the game.
Oh, I thought he became a fox.
He is not a sexy fox, sadly. He starts shooting the game on the island and just like roasting it in defiance of orders. The whole thing is a very 1990s style satire. And it is, among other things, a criticism of the kind of meddling of the very wealthy in politics with a nostalgic nationalist overlay.
And is it like secretly a book about the World Trade Center, or but not the World Trade Center, the World Trade Organization?
Right. So that was what was happening in that moment, right? Was the WTO protests and all that. And it certainly is about that. But very good, very specific to its moment. It predicts Brexit, like in many ways. I was reading it the week when we got the Hungary election results in. And the idea that, like, oh, maybe going too hard on kind of a isolationist nationalism will collapse your economy and everyone will have to go back to cutting their lawns with a scythe is like felt kind of relevant in that moment. So England, England by Julian Barnes, a deeply weird, deep cut, but very much on theme for the billionaires, politics, and an imagined history of us as a nation.
I think we are approaching a theme here because I also read a book about rich people and murder. Kat Rosenfield's new thriller, How to Survive in the Woods. So Kat's a friend. She's written for a reason a bunch of times. She's been on this podcast, right? Full disclosure, right? Like, I like Kat. We all know her here. But I really liked this book. It's just a really well-structured, well-paced page turner, right? The kind of thing that you're just going to plow through in, you know, a single evening or two, kind of find yourself staying up a little bit too late because it's just so enjoyable to read. She's written several books previously, including No One Will Miss Her, You Must Remember This. But this one's a little bit different. It's a little bit less of a murder mystery and a little bit more of a twisty thriller. It's a bad husband book specifically, and it is set in the final passages, the final section, the really difficult part of the Appalachian Trail. And it's about a young woman who is a tech, not a tech founder, but the daughter of a tech founder. And she herself is the founder of a sort of a wellness company. She is in an abusive relationship with a man who clearly just wants her for her money. And so she goes hiking with her husband and her husband's ex. Her husband's ex is also one of her good friends and maybe a little bit more than that. And murder is plotted. And things don't go as planned, right? So like I said, it's a thriller. There are a lot of twists, almost one in every chapter. I mean, this isn't a one big twist book. This is a twist, 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 sort of like things are slowly revealed kind of in each chapter. And this is part of what sort of pulls you along. It is not a political book. It is not a book that sort of has like a clear, distinctive political ideology. But there's great bits about like guns and self-reliance and just sort of like being able to take care of yourself that I think libertarians will like. And it's also, it's just, like I said, it's so nicely structured and so well plotted. Very satisfying, very entertaining. You will speed through it late into the night. Something I always think about with Kat is that she has said on a number of occasions that just kind of idly, she thinks about murder a lot. Like, not just when she's writing her books, just
when she's now.
Yeah, going through her normal life. And if you read her books, you can tell that's a compliment. How to Survive in the Woods by Kat Rosenfield, I really liked it.
I will, I read it last week or the week before, and I definitely stole a bunch of hours from Reason because I try to read when I go work out, you know, when I'm riding a bike or something. And I was like, okay, well, I'm not going to ride. I'm not going to go to the gym that much more. But I would come home and then I'd be like, yeah, I'll read till the next chapter or the next chapter. It's a incredibly, you know, just attractive and like powerful thriller in the way you're talking about. Like, you, if you start it, make sure it's kind of like LSD, you know, make sure you've got like 12 hours where you don't have to be anywhere because you're probably going to spend most of it reading the book.
Matt, do you have 12 hours for us?
So I went for the first time to the Museum of the City of New York, which is a perfectly fine, little, small, easy to digest, maybe a little bit expensive museum up on Central Park on the Upper East Side. It's lovely, two, three stories and whatnot. But I really went there to see a single exhibit called He Built This City. It's a 50 foot by 27 foot miniaturized replica of the entire damn city of New York. It's just incredible. A guy named Queens guy, artist named Joe Mackin, did it. Took him 21 years to do it. And you just go and you take in the enormity of the city and all of its crazy kind of geographical features. It's breathtaking. Check it out. It's going to be around for I think another month or two as an exhibit. And the museum itself, again, is very nice to see. But it's, if you've ever been to the Queens Museum, which is a terrific museum, that also has, I believe, like a big room where they kind of do the whole aqueduct system, like in 3D version, which is tremendous. That actually was his inspiration for this. I just sat there at home with like balsa wood and paint, and he just made every building and every bridge and every this and every that. And you can walk around it, and they got little binoculars, and it's just a terrific thing to take in. And kind of gives you all of the happy New York vibes to counteract your unhappy Zoran Mamdani vibes. So check it out. He built the city. Joe Mackin, I believe his name is, Museum of the City of New York. It's terrific.
Men will literally build a miniature replica of New York City instead of going to therapy. All right. That's our show, folks. If you like this podcast, if you like what we do at Reason, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. Thank you all for listening. The Reason Roundtable will return.